A great pleasure and honor to welcome at our institute Professor Martha Palmer from Boulder. And I think most of us have already met her and listened to her talk on semantic representations. On proper bank and issues connected with that. And today we are, I think, going a step further to the blocks world. When I say we are going a step further, I must say that when I saw the title and one of the sentences there, it just reminded me of Terry Winograd's block world, so I'm really looking very much forward to what we will hear today. So please, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. It's always, can you hear me okay? It's always a pleasure to be back in Prague, and today is especially gorgeous. The weather's really wonderful. So I'm sorry that I'm going to have to leave tonight. It's a very short visit, unfortunately, this time. I got spoiled when I was able to be here for a whole month in 2014, but maybe next time. Yes, this is, we are indeed, there's a new DARPA program, and guess what? We're working on the blocks world yet again, but with some new challenges. So Paul Cohen is the program manager. The name of the program is Communicating with Computers. And I'm going to be talking mainly today about something we call the ECCI store. Well, what in the world is that? Well, ECCIs are elementary composable ideas, which is sort of a new way of talking about semantic primitives or semantic concepts or basic concepts. Paul thought that he didn't want to bring any baggage from the word primitives, and so he had to have a new term for that. And it is being applied to the, we have kind of three different sort of domains of application. And I'll be saying a lot more about what the ECCI store is. But one is the blocks world, one is biological processes, and the other is narrative generation, as in getting the computer to tell stories. So this is nothing if not an ambitious DARPA program. Supposedly this common resource for elementary composable ideas is going to be useful for all three of these applications, which is quite a tall order. And I'm giving the talk today, but a lot of what I'm going to be presenting is based on work that I've been doing with many other people who are part of the program. We're funded on separate teams, separate individual grants, but Paul, in contrast with many DARPA programs, he's encouraging us to be very collaborative and to work together rather than compete with each other. You never know with DARPA. Sometimes it's all about, you know, who gets the best score, and if you get the worst score, your funding gets cut kind of thing, and the bake-offs. But this program is really sort of supposed to be different. So Susan Brown works with me at the University of Colorado, James Pustiowski at Brandeis, who I think is also a familiar visitor here, James Allen and Choman Tang from the University of Rochester, also affiliated with the Institute for Human Machine Cognition in Florida, Jerry Hobbs at ISI, Annie Zinen, who's at Stanford CSLI, Mark Burstein, who leads a group at SIFT, Luke Zettelmoyer at the University of Washington, Percy Liang at Stanford, and then Paul, again, as the program manager. So it's an exciting team. It's a little bit daunting, and the task is daunting as well. So this was one of the slides. We had a working group meeting about this in November in Colorado, and Paul sort of kicked off the meeting with this slide. So this is part our challenge. He said, so if say there's a human and a robot, very much like Schrödinger, like Winograd's blocks world, and you're asking the robot to do things in the blocks world, and you've been building a stack or a tower, and then you say to the robot, add a block, what would you expect it to do? Would you expect it to do this or to do this? And with no other context, you would expect it to do this. Now, if what you had said, if you'd been saying, okay, let's build a stack. All right, now let's turn it into an L, add a block. Then you might expect it to do this. And the question is, how would it know? How would the robot be able to figure that out? And it's actually a lot harder than it sounds. And then again, similarly, if you're in the context of building a row and you say add a block, then this would be what you would expect. But if you say, you know, you're building the row and then you say now let's turn it into an L, then add a block, you might get something like this. So, you know, how do we bring the, you know, what are the different pieces we have to put together? How much of the context do we have to bring to bear in order to get the robot to do the right thing? So the three J's and I, James Pischewski, James Allen, and Jerry Hobbs, sort of came up with this plan of action. That the story we want to tell is that in order to solve this, to get the computer to do the right thing, first you've got to do, appropriate linguistic analysis of add a block, and crucially, you've got to recognize the implicit arguments and what their reference should be, taking the discourse context into account. So that's the second step here. But also, crucially, you need to have a good representation of composite entities and the constraints on composite entities that will let you determine that if what you're building is a stack, that the next block goes on top. If what you're building is a row, the next block goes on the end. So we need all of these pieces. And so the really surprising thing when we all got together at that first meeting was how we've all been working on semantics for a long, long time from different perspectives and sometimes really arguing with each other about, you know, should it be done this way or that way. But when we sat down and looked at what we had all the different pieces we needed, and they were all quite compatible with each other. And this was stunning. It was really surprising. But so we're going to be looking at VerbNet and the TRIPS ontology. We're going to be looking at Jerry's axioms. Jerry Hobbs has a bunch of axioms and which will define our composite entities for us. We'll be looking at the generative lexicon in VerbNet and the ways in which they're similar and different. And then we'll talk about the rest of this stuff towards the end. But mainly we'll be focused on kind of this bit and putting the pieces together. So I'll just sort of walk you through the same process, but in a lot more detail, showing how each of these different pieces gets brought to bear. So we'll be looking mainly at the TRIPS parser, which has by far the best integration of the discourse context with the parsing process. We'll be looking at Jerry's, and we'll be looking at Jerry's axioms for the composite entities, which we'll be using as in conjunction with the TRIPS parser. But you can also tell the same story all the way through with just Jerry's axioms and his abductive reasoning. But I won't really try to go into the details of that, but I'll show you just a little bit about it. And then there are other alternative paths. So my own team for this particular DARPA program includes the University of Illinois, so Dan Roth and Julia Hochmeyer. And so Julia and I are working on a sort of CCG VerbNet parser that could also do the same thing that the TRIPS parser does, although at the moment it doesn't have that nice integration with the discourse context. So to start with the TRIPS parser, so this is a representation of just something like add one or add a block, so here's the verb here, add. So this is just like a dependency structure representation that already has identified that because this is imperative, it's a command, there's an implicit pronoun, that's this impro thing here, which would be you, add a block or add one, which would be the agent. This is telling you that it's a request because it's imperative in that context. And then the object of the sentence is the thing that's being affected, which you want to use some kind of reference resolution to identify in the context. So the only thing we really need to add to this is we want to add that the other implicit argument. So if I'm gonna, if I add a block, or I add one, I add it to something. So, which was not mentioned in the sentence, but is still there, and it's a very important piece. So, so we want to be able to add that implicit argument as well. And we can use VerbNet to do that. We could use PropBank. We could use the TRIPS ontology. You know, that we could use FrameNet. We could use the valency, English valency lexicon here. Anything that gives you subcategorization frames and some indication of arguments that are likely to be essential, that are likely to be implicit, even if they're not mentioned explicitly in the syntax. And that's to get us this third argument. So this is the, so VerbNet has an agent, a patient, and a co-patient. PropBank has an arg0, an arg1, and an arg2. The TRIPS ontology has an agent and an affected and a result. And the generative lexicon specifies a physical object and an assembly. So, you know, they're different names for the same thing. But so if we use VerbNet, then we've got our agent, our patient, and our co-patient. So we just would need to be able to map from the TRIPS parser the agent, affected, and result to agent, patient, and co-patient. And we can get a little bit more than that. So, so VerbNet gives us, for those of you who are familiar with it, it gives you a whole class of verbs that will all take, so add, this was in the mixed class, that all take these thematic roles. These are sort of selectional preferences for those specific roles that the agent has intentional control and that the objects are concrete. And then it also gives you a whole set of example syntactic frames. So this would be the one that's just the verb and the patient that can be associated with all the verbs in the class and some semantic components. So we've actually done a fair amount of tinkering with the semantic components, the semantic predicates that are associated with this particular syntactic representation because we've been trying to make them more compatible with the generative lexicon and with James Posuyevsky's ideas about event structure in the generative lexicon. So this is what we've come up with for this particular meaning of add, that at the beginning of the event, so this big E here is for the whole event. And we now have, which we didn't have before, sub-events, which were inspired by the generative lexicon. So you can think of this E as corresponding to all of the little E's in a set. So at the beginning of the event, the first sub-event, the patient is not a component of the co-patient. And then the agent does something, E2, what the agent does, this E2 causes E3, and the E3 is the new state in which the patient is a component of the co-patient. And this is of event type change of state, and for this particular sequence of particular type of event, we know that the end of the agent doing something is the beginning of the new state, that those two things meet temporally. And this is quite similar to, here's our generative lexicon representation of the same thing. This is a classic example of what James calls his opposition structure, where you start with a not component of and end with the component of. And in between, you've got an agent who's acting on the block. So here's our E1 and our E2. Now, he added this little thing here about that at the end of the event, the block is on top of Z. But really, he's cheating when he does that because at this point in time, you don't really know that. But that is where you want to get to. So the idea is that the VerbNet representations are now reasonably consistent with what the generative lexicon would like to have. And they're also consistent with Jerry's axioms, Jerry Hobbs's axioms for sort of adding things. So for all A, B, and C, if and only if A adds B to C, then there exists a series of sub-events where the agent is causing E0. So this is a little bit different because we had the agent doing something and then we had that something causing, but it's not a big difference. And then there's a change that takes place, and at the and what you end up with is your E2 is that B is a component of C. So it's the same sort of component idea. And this is a really nice representation because it's very general, and it works fine for the stack example, especially if you've got your right definition of stacks and rows and things. But you also it's also going to work for things like adding an egg to the cake mix, which on the surface seems to be quite similar. But if you think about it, so when you add the block to the stack, that block still retains its individual identity, and you could remove the block from the stack, no problem. If you add a programmer to the project, you could also remove the programmer from the project, and depending on the project, that person may not have been affected too much, and they might still be pretty much the same person they were at the beginning. Although there are some projects that I know of where there's one in particular. Do you remember the Janus DARPA MT program? This was where they were also trying to get people to collaborate. And Sergey Nirenberg and Yorick Wilkes and Edward Hovey were the three PIs that they were making work together on a machine translation project. And at the end of that five-year DARPA program, all three of them were divorced. Now, you know, who knows exactly how much that particular DARPA project had to do with that outcome, but they certainly were changed persons at the end of that project. But that's not what we would normally expect to happen. But when you add an egg to the cake mix, that egg, assuming that you actually crack it and stir it into the batter, is really changed in a very fundamental way. And there's no way in the world that you're going to remove that egg from that cake mix. So you've got some very different inferences that you want to bring to bear and that have to do a whole lot with what type of thing, what your co-patient is, what's the thing you're adding this to, but also to a certain degree with the type of object that's being added. Because if I had added chocolate chips to my cake batter or my cookie batter instead of an egg or after the egg, and then somebody came in and said, "Oh no, you can't put the chocolate chips in those cookies because we have to have the chocolate chips for this other thing instead." And I go, "Oh dear, I could have taken my mixture and put it in a strainer and run water over it, and those chocolate chips would still be there. The batter would be gone. I'd be have to start over again with the cookies. But, you know, I could have removed the chocolate chips, theoretically. I haven't ever tried to do that." So it's exactly what happens when you add something to something else is actually pretty complicated. And in order for the computer to get it right and get all the inferences right, you need to have a lot of information about the different types of objects and different outcomes of different types of adding. But this nice general component of thing right here is quite neutral with respect to how much B retains its individual identity. So it sort of works for all of these. So, okay, so back to our VerbNet representation. And this is our example sentence. Now we've got add another one, which is the one the TRIPS parser actually, I'll show you, ran on in a minute. So this question mark here indicates that this is a variable. It's not instantiated. And same thing for this question mark here. So we're going to, the patient is the one, so we can map that. We can instantiate that. And then we want to, you know, get the U as the value for agent, and we want to get the tower as the value for co-patient. And we want to be able to do the co-reference for another one and determine that it's really block two. So that's where And then that will give us, once we've done those instantiations, our goal of the block 2 being a component of the tower. So this is where the TRIPS parser and its integration with the discourse context is so important. So here's our TRIPS parser for add another one. So we've got our agent again with our implicit pronoun, and we've got the thing that's affected. And this is actually what the TRIPS parser does with another one. So this is the representation for another, which is telling you that it's in the ontology, it's an other that that the one is the figure with respect to the other, which is the ground. So you have to find out what the reference of this other one is in order to get the type of the one. Does that make sense? So James actually ran it with the, did the mapping to the verbnet roles and ran it again, and then got the additional implicit argument here for the co-patient. And then basically you have to do the next step is the reference interpretation. So, and this is the discourse context. This is, I'm sure, really hard to read, so let me blow it up for you. So this is what's happened already, the previous discussion in this context, that you just say, let's build a tower, put a block, and then put a block on the table. So let's build a tower gives you, and put a block on the table gives you a block. Okay, so you've got a block in your discourse context. You've had a putting event where the agent did something to the X1 and the result was R1. And the R1 is that the block, the X1, is on the T2, which is the ground, which is the table. So here's the table. And that you're trying to build a tower. The tower's been mentioned. So you want to get the referent of the another one to this block, and then of the co-patient to the tower. And then for the tower, you need to have this definition of it as a composite entity. So, which means that if you have a composite entity, then you have a set of components of that composite entity. And here is the specific Jerry Hobbesian definition of a stack, which says that you've got a composite entity C for all B, such that if and only if B is a component of C, then these two things are anded to must both be true, that either B is the bottom of C, or there's another block that is a component of C, and B is on that block. So it's either the bottom or it's on top of something else. And also this constraint that B is either the top of C or there's another block, and that block is on top of B. And then you have a definition of the bottom and you have a definition of the top. So once you've figured out that you're trying to put another block on the tower, and you've got that definition, then your goal is to put a block that is, so B1 was our first block, so we have to so we have to put another block, a block that is not B1, on the tower. So we either have to put it at the bottom of the tower or the top of the tower. So the robot might actually, the planner might have to think about trying to do both. Hopefully it would quickly figure out that putting it on the bottom is a bad idea because everything would fall over and you'd have to then rebuild the tower, so that putting it on the top is much easier. So your goal is... So your goal is, you know, you're adding a block to the table and adding it to the tower. So like I said, you can do this whole thing using Jerry's axioms and his abductive reasoning, but I'm not going to... And he did the presentation at the DARPA meeting where he went through all this in detail. I'm not going to try to do that. You can take his word for it. But you've got, if anybody wants to go through it in more detail, the slides are included, where you can see how he also does the resolution of the implicit arguments and a definition of put and all that. And then we've also looked at doing this, an alternative way to do it, instead of with the TRIPS parser, would be with the CCG parser, which can map directly to VerbNet, where you can get, the next slide is better. You can get, this would be the CCG representation of add with three arguments, and you can just expand that into a representation that Neo-Davidsonian representation that associates an event with the add and then pulls out the X as the agent, Y as the patient, and Z as the co-patient. Then you have all these different CCG lexical entries for the different types of syntactic frames that VerbNet would also be supplying you with. So this one right here is the imperative that has just one argument, which would have this semantic representation of so that you have your verb add, and then you're going to have the implicit pronoun, which she went ahead and said is specified as you, and then that something else that's given that has to be made explicit. So then if you use if you do the parse and have that lambda expression for your semantic representation, then what you'll get is that as the outcome is that the U here is the thing, if this is just add one, I guess, was the the U is going to be co-indexed with the patient. The one, there's two U's here. The letter U is going to be co-indexed with the patient, and then the X will be the U, and the Z will be the given thing. And then you still have to then figure out that the given thing is the tower. You've still got to do the integration with the discourse context. So that's kind of the goal of what we're doing under the DARPA program, is to sort of figure out how to put the pieces together that we need in order to give the right representation and actually be able to, you know, put the block in the right place. I haven't said anything at all about these other little pieces right here, so I'll say just a little bit about those in just a second. One of the ideas of trying to get all of these resources together in more or less interoperable format is that it gives the teams who are working on this, who are all trying to achieve the same goals, some choices about whether, you know, some of the representations are more formal, some are more informal, some are more fine-grained, some are more coarse-grained, some are more symbolic, some are more probabilistic. So it lets them pick the pieces that will best fit their own system and how they're doing things. And then there's also So we've just, all of this here, all of this apparatus is just for doing the Blox world. But we know we've got all this biology stuff as well. That's maybe not that different. It's different vocabulary, but it's fairly concrete. And a lot of the same principles will apply. We're also supposed to be doing this. So this is also supposed to be a resource that should be useful for the storytelling, the narrative generation. And that gets a whole lot more complicated because there, the stories are supposed to include gestures and music, just like the movies do. When you go to the movie and it gets real tense and the music gets real tense and then it gets real exciting and the music gets real exciting. And so I guess Paul's idea is that the computer should be able to at least select appropriate musical scores, if not compose appropriate musical scores, that would tell the same story that the words are telling. So then how do you include other kinds of resources? I mean, you know, we were actually really happy that you know, the different things we were doing fit together as well as they did to tell the story about the block. Paul was very dissatisfied with this because this, you know, putting these together, these are all just language resources. You know, that's easy, right? he wanted it to be a much more multimodal type of resource. So I'll say a little bit more about that. So first, though, let me just fill in these circles here, these white circles. So James Pustyovsky is also doing a lot of work on something he calls VoxML. So it's a Vox markup language for spatial information and also for sensory input. So where he associates with some lexical information, like say a plate, you know, there's a word for plate. But there's also a geometrical type, prototypical type or shape for a plate. There's a habitat, a natural habitat for places you find plates and things that you do with plates and types of actions you can perform on them. And an embodiment, which would allow you to put a plate on a relative scale with other things like forks and knives and tables and things like that. So he wants to be able to have his VoxML representations are supposed to encompass all of these different types of information, including visual images of these plates. So that's going to be the sort of link between the generative lexicon and sensory input. So you'd be able to use this VoxML gives you places where you could put information about visual and tactile sensory input. Then we've got these pieces we're putting together, which you could think of, you know, as like little Legos that you put together to build your language representation. But of course, Legos are quite rigid and they only fit if you've got exactly the right holes and things like that. And language is not that amenable to rigid representations. So we probably want our Legos to be a bit more flexible. And one way to try to do that is to be able to associate them with word embeddings. So this is the most exciting thing in natural language processing since, I guess, Bayesian nets. This deep learning and the neural network word vector representations that are often called word embeddings, which just having been trained on tons and tons of text will quite naturally put these kinds of words close together in a big multidimensional semantic space. So since these can be tuned to lexical resources. So Luke and Percy's idea is to do word embeddings and tune them to WordNet synsets. And since VerbNet already has mappings for a verb in a particular class to a WordNet synset, then that would let us try to access the word embeddings as a way to generalize the types of representations. So that's the idea of going by way of WordNets and sets to word embeddings to include that. And here we've got the VoxML for the sensory input. So moving forward, one of the things we're now having sort of decided that this is a good way to go. We're looking at sort of more general VerbNet / generative lexicon representations for just change of location in general, change of state in general, change of possession. So I'll just show you one representation for change of location that seems to be working for the VerbNet classes that include motion or change of location. This is from the run class. So we still have the agent doing something. We still have the thing the agent is doing causing a new sub-event. That's the wrong frame here. This is supposed to be agent, verb, patient, agent, verb, theme, trajectory. So agent, verb, theme, trajectory. So the theme is going to be in motion or going during the event. And then now this is, again, looking at the generative lexicon event structure and the first sub-event, the theme is at some initial location. We don't actually know where it is. It's not specified in the sentence, so that's the question mark. But you could think of this as kind of a precondition. Then for this particular sentence, the trajectory is instantiated. That's through the hoop. And then at the end of the trajectory, the theme will be at some new destination, which is like a result state. And then it's event type, change of location. And in this particular sentence, the trajectory just through the hoop maps directly to the trajectory. But you could have had some other direction information, like he crossed the field going towards the chapel, or he crossed the field towards the chapel, something like that. So you might have some additional spatial information that you could try to capture there. So this is, it's very similar to the add representation. It's actually works just the same I'm not going to show you more slides, but for change of state and change of possession, with the sort of something, the source and the goal for change of possession, and the initial state and the result for change of state. And then the sort of assumption behind all of this, like I said before, is that you've got this big event, you've got all these sub-events, and that the sub-events tend to have a particular structure associated with them. So we had sort of just gotten through figuring this out and looking at it with respect to several different classes when I got contacted by Mark Burstein at SIFT, who's also part of this whole program, who'd been looking at pushing and pulling. And he said this is what he thought should be the right representation for push. So he wanted an agent and an application of force. And the application of force would cause a motion of a theme along a path with a start location and an end location. And then there's temporal times associated with that. And the application of force would be... could use an instrument, an optional instrument. If it was the hand would be a likely default instrument. There would be some sort of manner of the application of force, which for pushing could be just a gentle, something gentle, could just be a touching manner. And then the big, the diff, for him, what was important was to be able to use the same representation for pulling with just two changes, two important changes, that for pulling something, the direction is away from, and the manner is has to be a bit firmer, more like a grasping manner in order to be able to pull something. So we looked at the representation in VerbNet, which I think, yes, I don't have, which is very similar to this new, it includes all of this this event structure stuff, which gives you the starting point and the ending point and the trajectory, which was exactly the same. Then it also had had an exertion of force instead of application of force, and a cause. So again, the surprising thing was that it was so similar. We had the same arguments, and we had, you know, this same, you know, we had the go for the move. We had the exertion of force. So the one thing we didn't have was this distinction between the pushing and the pulling. And of course, VerbNet is supposed to be representing things at the class level. This is verb specific, so it's extra information that you'd want to associate with each verb. But we also decided that that wasn't going to be we've been talking about this with respect to VerbNet for a while anyway, because it's something we wanted to add, was the ability to have more verb specific information with a class. So the plan is to, if you go to the VerbNet interface and you look for push, you get all of these classes back here. And this is telling you, you know, that it's in each one of these classes to make that a little bit bigger. So we decided we could add the verb-specific information here. So then if you just, so here's push in the push class, which was the right representation, and you just want to say that the direction is away from and the manner is touch, and then do the same thing for pull, and then, you know, we had the representation, exactly the representation he wanted. Maybe you have to have worked in semantics for many decades to appreciate how surprising it is that we're all coming up with the same representations for these things, and that it really does seem feasible to put together a resource where you could use this representation or this representation and basically be getting to exactly the same thing. But it's kind of exciting. So then, you know, what are the other things that, you know, where should we be going with this Ecce store, and what other things should we be doing with it? I mean, there's obvious questions for the people in the program about what makes it a useful resource, what would make it most useful, what formats do people need things to be in. Perhaps a more interesting question has to do with all of these additional multimodal resources. So we've spent some time at the last DARPA meeting talking about this, and it turns out there's quite a bit of stuff out there that is already, that could be added. So ImageNet, I understand, is already linked with WordNet SynSets. There's a visual VerbNet that these guys at Caltech are working on that they've been using for images as well. There are visual object classes. There's a lot of work on image schemas and gestures. So this is sort of where we're going to be trying to go next, is adding in sort of visual VerbNet, which is already linked to VerbNet. The people working on the gesture stuff have been subcategorizing their gestures into areas like actions, So you can talk about pushing something or pulling something, and there's some very explicit gestures people use to do that. So we're going to be looking at how, you know, how do those actions, you know, what are the representations of those actions in as gestures in visual verbnet, and then also the language representations for the same actions. And then the image schema stuff is really by far the most challenging. But the idea is that these image schemas can be both visual and also auditory, that's how the musicians talk about their compositions. And if you're talking about finding the right musical score for a story, then quite often they use image schemas to talk about the sort of the emotions rising and falling in the story, and then how you would want to try to represent that. So, and this, again, is something that James thinks he can use his VoxML to represent these image schemas. And then the idea would be to try to map between the VoxML and the gestures and the way the image schemas are represented in the gestures. And I'm really, really glad that I don't have to do that, because that seems very, very hard. I think this is going to be hard enough. So it's kind of scary. It's very ambitious, but it's exciting too. So the one of the long-term tasks is to get the TRIPS parser to be able to do stuff with image schemas by way of the generative lexicon and VoxML, both musical and visual image schemas, to do for all of the teams to be able to do appropriate contextual integration, to be able to do visual storytelling with gestures. Luckily, ISI did a bunch of Mechanical Turk experiments where they had people doing things with BloxWorld. So now we've got, understand that was a NACL paper, and they're making the data set's already been made available. So now we've got a whole bunch of sentences that talk about moving blocks around in the BloxWorld that we're going to be able to do stuff with. And they're also looking at generating alternative forms for those sentences. And we're gonna be working on this ISI data collection. We're starting with some action verbs like pushing and pulling. James is putting image schemas into VoxML. We're supposed to be looking at action gestures and avatar gestures and looking at all of these other resources. And in the long run, some of the questions that we want to be able to answer are, do you have to translate one-to-one? So between all of these different modalities, do you have to look at translating from, you know, say, music to vision and music to text as two completely separate tasks? Or is there some kind of interlingua representation that would make that you could translate everything into the interlingua? Who knows? And what are we going to learn about semantics from doing all this? And thanks to DARPA for giving us such an ambitious challenge. Thank you very much.
such a cooperation, and also
right.
Resources that have been together before can be used or should be used to make the task a little bit easier.
We hope.
Thank you very much. And I'm sure it's open for questions or comments or remarks.
You think we're nuts.
Have you thought about actually using the language as the interlingua? Because that might be easiest Because the formal stuff, I mean, it's nice that people can get together and sort of agree, you know, what to use from the logic perspective and from the semantic, you know, linguistic semantic perspective and so on. But I can imagine that it would be much easier for the people from the image world and the music and gestures to actually describe, to use natural language as the sort of description of what otherwise would be only visual or, mm-hmm. or otherwise.
Well, like certainly for the work that people are doing with image captions and things like that, the textual descriptions of the images seem to be a really good way of generalizing and being able to collect all of the images that have cats, for instance, or so you just use the word cat, you know, you describe them all. So yes, but for the visual stuff, I can kind of see that working. For the music stuff, that they do use sort of vocabulary. They have a vocabulary for describing these different things. I think figuring out it quite often the way they use the vocabulary, they're different meanings than the kind of sort, you know, so we have to get very precise, I think, about what the meanings of the words are that they're using to describe things. But if we can do that, then sure, maybe you're right. Would be worth trying.
To get some more linguistic information, in the team, which you have quoted at the beginning, if you take into account some linguistic information that's English, or do you also have somebody on the team who can add some multilingual input?
At the moment, this is all just English. It's very English-centric. But you're right. I mean, certainly if you go to all this trouble, you'd like it to be a little bit more, you know, general purpose than just English. I don't think DARPA cares. So there has been work on doing, you know, verb nets and frame nets in other languages, which have been surprisingly successful. And I think, I mean, I don't know, you never did give me the changes that you made to the PropBank frame files when you did the English valency lexicon. But I don't think there was a huge amount of changes. And I don't know how well the English valency lexicon maps to the Czech valency lexicon either. We could certainly look at some things like that. And especially because it is the blocks world, it's quite a narrow focus. So we could start with just change of location, for instance, and say, you know, just start with like that VerbNet representation and then just see how well that representation would work for the verb nets in other languages and the Czech valency lexicon and, you know, the frame nets in other languages. And I would actually guess that it would be, in fact, fairly general purpose. That you tend to, most languages tend to make, you know, explicitly mention the starting point and the ending point and some information about the path, you know, so.
And another very small remark. I don't know too much about Jerry Hobbs' abduction. I know a little bit, but not very much to be able to answer my question by myself. The question is, when I looked at your two introductory images or pictures, I just thought about some possibility of ordered entailments which you can take into account that there are some entailments in a, I mean, that's what Deirdre Wilson and Sperber had in their theory of relevance,
yeah.
That there is a certain ordering and that there may be different entailments, but one of them is more at hand than the other, and you can
yeah.
make some order in those.
Yeah.
Is there some notion of that involved? Or
I don't know enough about it to answer that question either. I'd have to ask Jerry.
Because it might be relevant for the understanding of the of what is said. I mean, add a block, I don't know, maybe the highest order entailment, maybe just put it on the ground or on the top or something like that. So it was just something mm-hmm. which occurred to me in relation to the block scene.
It would be nice if the robot tried putting it on the top before it tried putting it
yeah.
on the bottom.
Yeah.
If we could get that to fall out.
So,
oh, and by the way,
yeah.
this whole program is all about, you know, getting the robots to do this. But DARPA has sent each team a sort of Blocks World apparatus so that we're all working in exactly the same environment so we can do evaluations and stuff. And there's no robot. There's the table and the blocks and there's a camera and stuff like that. There's no robot. So we actually, once the planner figures out what should be performed, you have to get a person to do it.
So there's more space for some further remarks or questions? Or yeah.
I can imagine that it can work well for, let's say, words of location, but what about, for example, verbs of mental action, like forgive or something like else? How would your model work, for example, for some verbs of mental action, like forgive or?
So we have sort of semantic predicate representations for all kinds of information transfer things. So like, you know, telling someone something or teaching someone something, stuff like that. And of course, it's similar to change of possession, but there's a very important difference because in change of possession, you know, if I give you this pen, then I don't have the pen anymore myself. But if I teach you something about verb representations, I still have that knowledge. So, you know, but you still sort of have a kind of end state in which the student now has this knowledge, you know, that so there's a change of state involved. So, and you can do the same kind of thing for forgiving as well. But it's, you know, it's a very high-level representation. You know, I think I was really mad at my sister about something for a long time, and then I finally forgave her. That was much more an internal change for me. It wasn't really a change of state for her so much. It was more that my internal state changed. In the same way that perceiving something, if I see something, you know, my internal state changes. So I think you can still, at a high level, represent sort of that there's a change that's occurring and the participants in the change. In another program where we've been talking to Bill Croft about his event force dynamics, where he has even more detailed representations of events and sort of specifically for an event trying to show on a timeline, because you can have several participants in an event. And I really need to have a good example of this. Because you know, you have a timeline for the whole event, but like for the pushing thing. You know, do you have any chairs? You don't have anything on wheels here. Well, this is on wheels. I mean, I could presumably give this, you know, push this, and then it would carry on. Maybe I could push it across the room by just giving it a shove right now, and then it would just go all the way across the room. So then my involvement in the event is only at the very beginning, but the event continues, and this table would continue to move for a longer period of time. So he actually uses image schemas, in fact, to represent that the participant of the pushing event is, you know, the action comes at the very beginning of the event, whereas the change of location of the table would go on much longer over the duration of the event. So he has no formalization. There's no textual representations of the involvement of the participants. It's all just done with these two-dimensional graphs. So that's kind of a challenge in and of itself, is to figure out how to take that information that he's capturing and turn it into something that's more like first-order predicate logic that you could imagine the computer reasoning with. That was sort of a long answer.
So, well, I think we are looking forward to the information we can get on the results or partial results, and I think we'll be eager to follow from which part of the project you can achieve. You can go furthermost, I would say, in the project. I have one more, but it's a very minor question. In your one of the schemes, you also indicated alongside with audio and image processing also speech acts, but then I haven't seen it through your presentation. But I think this is something which is which would belong to the implications or entailments which might be.
So there's actually another circle here for speech acts. But then it's not real clear what it maps to, you know, because none of us are really representing speech acts. You know, none of these current resources are doing anything very useful with speech acts. I mean, we have there's a couple of VerbNet classes that are sort of, there's one for illocutionary forests. So for things like I dub thee knight, I pronounce you man and wife, you know, those kinds of very sort of well-defined speech acts. But of course, that territory could be much broader than that. And so maybe we should talk about that. You might have some suggestions.
No suggestion, but I was curious to see where it would fit in the scheme.
Yeah, it should go definitely here, because there are gestures that go along with certain speech acts. But yes, but where else, I'm not sure yet.
Okay. So, again, I would like to thank our speaker, Professor Palmer, for her presentation. We only may wish good luck to you and the team, and we would be very happy if we can hear from you personally how things go on and on. Now, for the audience, this is the last talk within Fred Jelinek series in this academic year. Next Monday, we will switch to Czech and to Czech environment, and we will have Professor Jana Hofmanová here to say something about discourse and discourse structure and pragmatics. I mean, that kind of field, and that will be the last talk in our seminar for this academic year. And as you have seen from the email today, 3 weeks from now, that is Monday the 30th, there is a symposium, seminar, colloquium, call it whatever you wish, to devoted to Peter's Gall and and the different interests he has shown during his 90 years of life. So that's at the Faculty of Philosophy, and it's on Monday from 3 to 5 in the afternoon. So thank you very much, and see you next week. Yeah.